Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're gonna learn today.
Innovate like a startup, deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's gonna be a great day.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Oh yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Lero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 157. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Arrow, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, sir?
I'm feeling kind of sweaty, Pete.
Sweaty. Why are you sweaty?
I was playing
aside
this,
from living in Houston.
Yeah, well, you know, the swamp is what the swamp is. I was just playing with my VR headset, and I was playing this game called Beat Saber. It's a lot of fun, but you end up jumping back and forth and swinging around like
holy cow, look at that thing. Let me put that on. Let me see that. What? Wow. That thing looks intense, man. All right, awesome. Well, look, again, you did it. You found a perfect segue. We are talking a little bit about virtual reality this week. We're talking about AR, VR, but our good friend Duncan, he actually took a take three recently, and I want to hear all about that, where he learned all about some remote rendering. So why don't we bring on Duncan first to talk about this. Duncan, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, guys. What's up?
Good, man. How you been?
Yeah, not too bad. I can't complain. Well, actually, I can complain a lot, but not about the podcast or work.
Yeah, good call. Good call. Well, you're not alone. You're bringing a good friend of the podcast with you, Alan Renouf, who's also works a lot in AR and VR. So, Alan, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, mate. It's good to be back. How you doing?
Yeah, man. So, Alan, we got questions for you as well, but I want to start with Duncan. So, Duncan, you recently took a take three. So for the benefit of the audience that might not know what that is, why don't you tell us a little bit about what a take three is?
Yeah, sure. It may be good as well to start at the beginning, at least for me, when I took the decision to look at these take three opportunities. I've been doing the same job for about 5 or 6 years. And within VMware, for people that have been around, they have this program, as I said, that's called, as you mentioned, that's called take three. And the take three program basically allows you to take 3 months out of a year after 5 years worth of service to focus on something else. And it's typically intended for, you know, people like myself, yourself, that have been doing the same thing for a long time and basically just want to, you know, get out of the comfort zone and try to figure out what else is out there and, you know, learn new things, whether that is from a management perspective, technology perspective, you know, or even about, you know, about yourself. It could be anything, right? So I went to this Take 3 portal, and there was this extremely long list of all of these opportunities. And to me, actually, one of them stood out primarily because a few years ago, I saw this guy up on stage called Alan Renouf, together with Pat Gelsinger at VMworld, presenting on the topic of virtual reality, and they were migrating virtual machines from on-premises into the cloud by moving them or throwing them within virtual reality over a fence. That was so awesome. And
I remember that.
I saw this opportunity, but it had nothing to do with what I saw at that point in time. But, you know, Alan and I go way back, so I figured I would reach out to Alan and ask him if that was an opportunity that would, you know, be open for myself. I mean, with these types of opportunities, it actually lists the skill set that you're supposed to have.
Yeah.
Didn't really meet the current skill set that I had, but Alan said, you know what, I think you'll be able to figure things out and we'll just see what happens. So yeah, I took the opportunity from a take three perspective, and I started out in December, and then it went on until the end of February, which was interesting to say the least.
Yeah, I bet.
So you pulled off you pulled off your VR headset, and a couple things had changed.
Yeah, well, quite a few things had changed. The Corona started after I stopped with the project, so that was interesting. But just being back in the regular world was also quite interesting, to be honest, John.
I think the great thing about take threes from the other side of the fence, from my point of view, is that, you know, we have these chunks of work that we need to do, and we don't always have the people to be able to do that. So from our point of view, we can essentially raise a chunk of work inside of the VMware system and say we're looking for somebody smart to come join us. You know, as it was, we got Duncan, but, you know, you give him your take.
Well, yeah.
But
are we discriminating against the Dutch here, Alan?
Not at all. No, it's just Duncan I discriminate against. But, you know, we managed to get Duncan, which was, you know, awesome from my point of view. We needed somebody from the infrastructure side. We needed somebody that knew the ins and outs of vSphere.
Yeah.
We needed somebody that was going to, you know, take that to the limit. And I know the way that Duncan works, and, you know, I was pretty keen to get him on board. So I think it was awesome that we got him to come and tackle that piece of work for us. And I'm sure we'll go into more detail about what that was.
Yeah. And I think the other interesting thing from your side is as well, if you look at it from a funding perspective, right, I'm still on the HCIBU payroll as I do these 3 months. So, you know, for these guys, it's kind of like free resources, although they need to have, there's, of course, you know, investment from their side as well in terms of explaining to me what the project is and, you know, holding my hand and going through the process and emotion. But the key idea with these types of things is that it's a set project and you try to complete it within 3 months, you know, by yourself as much as possible. So it's a very interesting concept. And for those listening that work for VMware and have been with the company for 5 years or longer, I would highly recommend to look at the Take 3 portal and figure out if there's an opportunity that, you know, fits you or you feel that you could actually contribute to.
Oh, yeah. I like it.
We've had someone from our team. We've had some people come into our group through this. And the cool thing is you also just get connections into completely different organizations. You know, having someone from the support team work with our tech marketing, they get an appreciation for how to get content and things out, learn some skills. Inversely, we get a better understanding of their workflow. It's kind of like it's a fun exchange program, I guess, so to speak, in that regard.
I agree.
Totally. You get a fresh perspective on the work that you're doing as well. You know, I've been living this stuff for a year and a half now. So to have somebody new come on and somebody that I respect their opinion, you know, I can just basically say, hey, this is what we've been doing up until now. What do you think? What are we doing wrong? You know, how can we make this better? And, you know, by the way, here's this work that we want you to help us with.
I like it. So let's get into it. So augmented reality, virtual reality. Alan, I know you've been in this for a while. I've seen your VMworld presentations. I saw the stuff that you were doing at VMworld. For those that haven't, you should check those out. They're still out there on YouTube. So Duncan, what was the project you worked on?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to explain first. I know Alan was on the the podcast a couple of episodes ago. I'm pretty sure that he discussed VR and AR in depth, but I think the first thing that is useful to explain is that if you look at these traditional VR, and I probably shouldn't be using the word traditional because they haven't been around for that long, but if you look at these VR and AR solutions, there's, you know, two different types of solutions. First of all, there's the head-mounted display, which is directly connected using a cable to a laptop or a desktop. You know, these are typically high fidelity, so high quality from a graphics perspective solutions. They are rather heavy, typically expensive as well. And the challenge with these types of things is that they're not really flexible because they're directly connected to a laptop or a desktop, which means that if you want to move to a different room, you need to move a laptop or desktop with you. On top of that, you're also walking around potentially with IP, you know, in your backpack, right? The application, the data, whatever it is that is associated with the application that you're using.
Just to add on to what you said before you go into the next style as well, you've also got the cost of the laptop with the heavy GPU in it. You've got the cost of the headset. And what people don't think about most of the time is the actual cost of setting that up, because it's traditional Windows software. You have to get everything working. You have to have our drivers installed. You have to have, you know, potentially Steam VR up and running. So all of that stuff, whilst it might not sound too hard, it ends up taking a while. And if anyone's ever used Steam VR before, they'll know the updates that come out, you know, sometimes just kill your headset. So take a bunch of troubleshooting and, you know, that cost of support for this is hard.
I was going to say also, I mean, anyone who's ever played a video game knows that you need resources. You need a good graphics card, you know.
Right.
You know, and so, yeah, the cost of your local machine is probably going to be significantly higher than, say, just your run-of-the-mill laptop.
Exactly. My PC heats the room when this is all running. Like, between that and, like, the locomotion of you standing up, like, I have to turn on the AC. So it's not a small investment.
Yeah, and the locomotion is obviously restricted because you're cabled in there as well. You're not going to be doing 360s around. You're not going to be doing pirouettes in a ballet.
Oh man, you know? I don't know. Like there's some times where I'm playing super hot where I really do feel like I'm in the Matrix, like, you know, doing the Keanu Reeves moves. But
yeah, so yeah, back to you, Duncan.
No, for sure. I think those are very valid points. I mean, from a cost perspective, these systems are not optimal, and also from an operational perspective, it's rather complex. So the other solution that is out there is the standalone head-mounted display, something like the Oculus Quest, for instance, where you're not cabled to a machine. And Alan is holding one up. You can't see it when you're listening to the podcast, but I would advise you to just simply Google for Oculus Quest. And if you see these devices, they're quite intriguing because you can simply wear one of those devices. You're not connected to an external machine, but they have, you know, a downside as well. First, the other upside, by the way, is that they are relatively cheap. So, you know, we're talking about $400, $500, depending on which version you end up buying, the amount of memory that they have. Yeah, it's relatively cheap. But on the other hand, they're also relatively low-powered devices, meaning low-powered as in they have a relatively, you know, tiny CPU and they have some GPU capacity, but it's, you know, it's relatively small as well. Of course, you can't compare it to a GPU that sits in a laptop or a desktop, which also means that from a graphics perspective, the output is going to be significantly different. So, you know, it's going to look different. Although these devices are, I would say I've played with one that Alan's team provided for a while. The output is actually pretty decent. You can't compare. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't compare well to those more expensive solutions. And, you know, the obvious reasons for it being is the way that the graphics are being produced. So the CPU and GPU capacity is relatively low. Now,
and you said the you know, the output on these mobile devices is pretty decent, but believe me, to get to that point, there's a lot of work that goes on. There's a lot of technology that goes into it, whether it's things like foveated rendering, where they kind of you know, blur the outsides the further out that you get, so that the focus point is dead in the middle, and that's what you see at the highest quality. And it kind of moves out after that, or whether it's, you know, when you're developing the applications, making sure that you're creating, you know, the shapes with the least amount of polygons and, you know, textures that you know, high quality, but are kind of smaller in size and you can wrap around objects. There's a ton of work that you need to do to get to the point where you actually have something that's performant on these headsets.
Yep. Again, very valid points. And I think, you know, one of the questions that the team asked is, you know, what can we do to get, you know, the best of both worlds? In other words, you know, how can we potentially use one of these standalone head-mounted display devices, not attached to anything, but still leverage the power of a GPU and provide some form of manageability as well by potentially virtualizing these workloads? And that is where remote rendering came into play.
Yeah, that's good. So real quick, we did an episode. You should check it out. It's episode 136, where Alan dove kind of deep on spatial computing in general to identify some of the reasons that you might be using this in the workplace. And then, you know, so I want to maybe just touch on that just a little bit before we dive into what remote rendering is and what were some of the things that you discovered. So Alan, give us a quick understanding of what spatial computing looks like in the enterprise.
Yeah, sure. So there's a number of different use cases that we discussed in that episode. And spatial computing really does come down to, you know, a couple of form factors at the moment, whether it's augmented reality, where you have, you know, the digital objects within your view. You could imagine this like you're wearing a pair of glasses and we're able to project the information, the relevant information in front of you. And it's kind of contextually aware. So it knows where my walls are, where my desk is. It can identify objects like using the cameras in front of these glasses. It can understand that I'm looking at a laptop or that I'm looking at a piece of machinery that I need to work on and kind of give me the correct information based upon what I'm seeing right there. And then you've got, you know, virtual reality where you're kind of in this world that's been completely created and fabricated for you by software and takes you to an entirely different place. The main areas that we're looking at the moment from the enterprise perspective is, you know, first of all, from the device management side of things. So once these devices go into IT, do you really want to somebody from IT saying, hey, you know, what the hell is that? How do I manage it? What you want them to do is treat it like another device, treat it like your mobile phone or your laptop, be able to actually introduce that into their IT procedures and their IT applications and network and fully understand how to manage that device, control it, and make sure that they can, you know, wipe it, push applications to it, add certificates to it, add Wi-Fi connections, stuff like that. So, you know, managing the device is probably the first place that we would start. Secondly is actually accessing the applications. So we're working on ways that you can potentially hook into your Horizon environment and hook into your workspace environment and see the applications that are delivered to you from IT, be able to log in and get those applications, launch those applications, whether it's in a kind of a spatial way so that you see the windows and you're able to interact with your traditional applications,
yeah,
or whether it's more of the immersive applications that exist that you've purchased or written in-house that you need to grant people access to. And then, you know, thirdly, there's the actual use cases that people are using this for. And there's a number of different use cases depending on the enterprise that we're talking about, the vertical that we're talking about. You know, some of the interesting stuff around healthcare is a great article the other day where they were at Stanford. They were actually using a full body scan of a child that they were about to perform surgery on to remove cancer.
Wow.
And what they did is they took that full body scan and they projected it into virtual reality. And then through that, the surgeons were able to go in and perform the surgery time and time again until they knew how to do the procedure in the correct way. And as it was the child's body, you know, there were kind of no unexpected ways to do that. And
that's incredible.
And the great thing about virtual reality is you can start throwing different scenarios at them as well. So, you know, maybe they do this surgery through virtual reality and they think, yeah, you know, I can do this. But then you can throw things in like, you know, what if this blood vessel breaks and what if this happens and what if that happens, and, you know, and really, you know, get them so that they can fully understand what they're going to do and being counted for everything that was going to go on. And as it was, they went in there and when they were doing the surgery, it went absolutely flawless because they'd done so much practice beforehand.
Nice.
So there's a ton of different use cases out there, you know, depending on which vertical you're in.
Well, and we've had immersive training just to think about in other areas like aerospace. Like these flight simulators that cost an absurd amount. I mean, I remember working on some military ones where this was years ago, they had like 14 1080p projectors, like this cocoon around you to simulate the entire, you know, whatever you were doing. But those things were ungodly expensive. And so we're able to take that level of immersion and retry and retrain and retrain that we force on pilots because, you know, we want them to not kill us, but put that into all these other areas, into maintenance, into health. The healthcare is really cool just because that's something that I guess not everyone realizes on surgery, how much fatigue ties into that. You know, there are people who, okay, you may have the eye-hand coordination, but if you can't get this done in 12 hours, at the end of 12 hours, like, your hands are going to be tired. You don't want to have handoffs in the middle of this. You don't want to be tag team and be like, oh, here's halfway through the surgery. Here's the new guy who's fresh. And, you know, but you see these pictures of these long, drawn-out surgeries where, like, people are passed out on the floor at the end. You know, it's cut that time down.
Yeah, it reminds me of I was talking to somebody from the armed forces the other day, and they were talking about how they invoke stress to make the virtual experience more realistic. And they were saying that they actually give people slight electric shocks to invoke stress whilst they're in VR.
Oh, wow.
So they're really taking immersion to the next level.
Pete, you're not allowed to sneak up behind me with a stun gun while I'm playing Beat Saber. or like punch me while I'm playing Super Hot. Like.
Bollocks.
All right. Well, listen, Duncan, I want to talk to you about this concept of remote rendering, because as we all know, this stuff is great, but it's very resource intensive. So I understand that you have a presentation that you shared, you know, so you dove pretty deep into what remote rendering is and why this is so important. So maybe you can share a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. I think, Alan, I think you went over the use cases in a decent way. So that gives you a good understanding of, you know, what kind of problems are out there and why people would want to use virtual reality or augmented reality in the first place. And we already mentioned there are a bunch of challenges with these different types of headsets. So that's why we started looking into a solution that would at least allow you to get the best of both worlds, meaning, as what you mentioned, running graphic intense workloads on these devices that are not directly connected or tied to a physical machine. So what this remote rendering is all about is basically, it's all about virtualizing your virtual reality application, running on top of, you know, potentially vSphere in our case, and then somehow rendering the output of that application, sending it over Wi-Fi to your physical headset. So that is the concept itself. And yeah, but there is, of course, a whole bunch of challenges around that. It sounds rather basic, but if you start looking at the stack itself, and I think that was, for me, the most challenging part. Yeah, I was familiar with vSphere, as Alan already said, and, you know, I would say that I know vSphere reasonably well. But if you look at the stack that comes into play when you talk about these types of solutions, first of all, you talk about a headset. With a headset, of course, you have some form of, you know, sensory, or you have controllers. Then you need to have a remote client. The remote client needs to connect to a remote server. The remote server, of course, has a connection to a VR application. The VR application runs on top of a framework called Steam VR, which is the virtual reality framework. Then, of course, we need to have something that actually renders the output of that application. So that would be the GPU, to which you also have things like a GPU driver associated. It all runs on top of or inside of Windows 10, which runs on top of vSphere, which is managed by vCenter Server. So, you know, it's a rather extensive solution. We're not just talking about the remote rendering protocol. We're actually talking a complete stack. And I think that was also the most challenging part of this this whole project. And when I started looking into it, Ellen and the team mentioned, you know, there was already a couple of solutions out there. So you may want to, first of all, start testing with this open source solution. And this open source solution was called ALVR. And, you know, to be honest, it looked very promising. A lot of people are using it. And I started testing it in my home lab. But quickly, you know, I discovered that it wasn't really the solution that was going to work for the enterprise. And the reason was actually quite simple. When they designed ALVR, it was primarily targeting, you know, people playing games at home. That's primarily what the solution was based on. And the big challenge with it is that it was an actual application, and the application runs within a virtual machine. And in order for you to use remote rendering in this particular case, you need to run the application, connect the application physically to the headset, meaning you go to the application, you click within the application, select the headset that needs to be connected to. And you can imagine when you have an enterprise organization, you potentially have 10 or 15 or 20 or 500 of these headsets.
Yeah.
You don't want to go into 500 virtual machines and connect them directly from an ALVR perspective, from a remote rendering perspective, to a headset. It's just impossible to maintain.
It's like so the AI where you're doing manual clones and here's yours to RDP2 and here's yours to RDP2.
Exactly.
It's like...
Yeah,
it's impossible. It's a
nightmare. It's not enterprise ready. It was written for gamers, essentially, to stream. Yeah.
And it did. I mean, from that perspective, it actually worked quite well. When I got it up and running, I had some initial challenges. When I got it up and running, it actually worked okay. I still found it a bit, you know, unstable. But, you know, from a manageability perspective, you know, it was obvious that it wasn't really the solution that we could use. We started looking at the rest of the landscape out there, and there were two solutions that popped up. AMD has a solution called Relive VR, and then NVIDIA has a solution called Cloud XR as well. And these solutions were more targeted towards professionals, and from an NVIDIA standpoint, I should probably say enterprise. I think AMD is more focused on professionals, and NVIDIA is more focused on the enterprise. Both solutions, though, are not an executable in terms of a program that you would actually have to run, but they are installed as a driver. So you install a driver and you connect the headset from a driver perspective directly to that virtual machine. And then you have a one-on-one connection. So as soon as you have it configured, you can keep on using the same pairing. So the same headset and virtual machine combination, which is a lot easier to use. So you don't need to manually go in, power on the run the program and connect it every single time individually. And I started looking at these two solutions. One of the things I think that stood out to me is if you looked at AMD and you looked at NVIDIA, it was quite obvious that from a go-to-market perspective, AMD was focusing on the gaming community, where NVIDIA, you know, they came out instantly and said, okay, this is going to be our solution for remote rendering for enterprise organizations. And that is one of the reasons we decided to do all of our testing going forward with NVIDIA. Plus, in our lab, we also happen to have a lot of NVIDIA equipment. So we had the NVIDIA graphics cards, the RTX 6000 in my home lab, and then the RTX 8000 in Palo Alto, close to Alan's office, which produced a lot of heat and noise, but was very, very helpful to have available in that lab, because it basically allowed us to test everything end-to-end.
So one question I have is, where do the bottlenecks come up when you inject latency? I know just streaming a regular 4K stream is about 25 meg already from a bandwidth perspective. I assume when you do this, you know, not only throughput, but also latency, like what are the requirements for user experience? How far can I roam from that video card? How close do we need to keep video cards? If I'm going to work from home, do I really want to stream from my office? Or is this something that like is embedded in the WAN providers or in the CDN networks? Like where do we put this stuff?
Now you're seeing why we got Duncan involved. These are all the kinds of questions that our customers were coming to us with, right? They had the need to do this remote rendering, but then all of these questions suddenly pop up when you start understanding the technology and understanding what it's trying to do. Because it's not like you said, it's not a desktop that we're pushing over here. It's your entire world, potentially.
Yeah, and this is also where it starts to become challenging, to be honest, because I think it's good to break it down. For me, this was a whole new world as well, right? When I started talking to Alan about this, he's like, well, you know, these are some of the challenges, and talking about things like motion sickness. And then you start, you know, Googling, you know, how do these things actually occur? Well, apparently there was this term out there called motion to photon latency. I'd never heard about this thing. I know about latency, but what the heck is this motion to photon latency thing? Well, the first thing that popped up was this metric and the threshold for it. The threshold apparently is around 20 milliseconds. I had no idea why it was, and I had no idea what it was to begin with. But basically what it is from the point in time where you move your head around, your brain expects a change from a scenery point of view. So basically what you're seeing within the headset itself, that okay. image should reflect the change that, or at least the position that your head moved towards, right? Your brain basically expects that to happen within roughly 20 milliseconds. You know, for some people, it could be 25. For others, that could be 12.
But someone this who's motion a couple gin and tonics in, maybe a little more. Like
exactly. You know. But this motion to photon latency is really, really crucial. You know, and I'm looking at this number, you know, being having spent the last 5-6 years in storage, I'm like, 20 milliseconds, that's like a lifetime, right? Well,
I think it's interesting to understand why that is the case as well, because then you start getting into, you know, one of the things I like about working with this kind of technology is you quickly get into the medical reasons as to why things happen. And I thought it was interesting that the reason that it actually makes you sick when you have a slow photon to motion latency is that it's your body's way of telling you that something isn't correct. And the reason it does that is that sometimes, you know, obviously back in the day when we were all roaming the planet and with our clubs, we were eating berries. And when you would eat something that was potentially poisonous, it would cause you to have this kind of effect that we are seeing now in virtual reality. And your body's natural instinct is to actually throw up to get rid of that poison from your body. So it's interesting to see how, you know, in virtual reality, we're now seeing the same results from obviously a different source.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I just figured that was like 20 milliseconds was as much as your brain has for a jitter buffer. But no, that makes a lot.
Well, that's definitely the case as well. And the throwing up part, I'm pretty sure I've tested that quite a few times in my home office, because that's the thing, right? When you start playing with these types of technologies, of course, your configuration is not going to be optimal the very first time you test it, and not the second time and the third time as well. So I could typically only spend like, you know, 2 or 3 minutes at a time within virtual reality testing these types of technologies, basically because of the motion to photon latency and the fact that you know, I would be hanging above a bucket for a couple of minutes afterwards. So
just to be clear, Alan gave the throw up test to the new guy. I got it.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely what happened. And the interesting part is as well, right? 20 milliseconds sounds like a lot, but when you look at the different layers, as I've already mentioned, you have this remote rendering client, you have remote rendering server. They connect over Wi-Fi. Then there's the VR application. There's the Steam VR framework that sits in between. There's a driver that comes into play from a GPU perspective. Now, there's, of course, Windows 10 involved. There's a physical GPU involved. And there's also vSphere involved from a scheduling standpoint. So if you start adding up all of those layers, well, you know, you easily reach 10, 12 milliseconds to begin with. That's the minimum, right? So that 20 millisecond barrier, if there's any form of contention anywhere, you'll be hitting that easily.
Sure.
So that is something very, very challenging. And I think that's also something that kept us occupied for the most time, trying to figure out what can we do to lower the overhead, yet at the same time come up with a solution that actually allows customers to run multiple headsets on top of a single physical machine. Because there's no point in buying a physical server with a very expensive GPU if you can only connect a single headset to it. Yeah, you know, it may be useful from an operational perspective, but that physical GPU typically is around, you know, $4,000 to $5,000.
Yeah. Did some of the enhancements to vSphere 7 contribute to this project? Because I know there were some changes around GPU.
No, actually, we didn't test vSphere 7. So within vSphere 7, they made some changes around GPU technology, but it's more around the assignment of GPU technology.
Yeah.
It's not about the use of the GPU technology itself. So it's more around, you know, how does it interact with HA and DRS? It's not as much about, you know, scheduling of GPU workloads, but it's definitely something that we should be testing to see from a latency perspective, because I can imagine that there were enhancements from a scheduler standpoint, from a vSphere point of view, that could potentially help as well lowering the overhead. But it's something that at least I haven't tested, but I'm pretty sure that the guys will be testing in the near future.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I want to quickly go back to as well, Duncan, you know, mentioned the cost about having this service out there with one user on it. I think it's interesting to understand the use cases a lot of the time, and you know, and potentially some of the other things that you can do with that server as well, because it's not like you're going to have one person sat there 24 hours a day with one headset on connecting to that server. So as soon as we start to virtualize and make that available from a data center, and you can potentially have time slots where multiple people can hook into that and use that as and when they need it. So, you know, we're now talking about enabling multiple people to access that one server that costs a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
Based upon when they need it, not, you know, not consistently. The other thing is that you've got a hefty GPU in there. When you're not using it for VR workloads, that could be repurposed. It's a virtual environment. We could have other virtual machines running on there to make use of that GPU to go and crunch some data or do something else. So I think the cost certainly from the outset seems like a lot. But when you start thinking about the other things that you can do with that server and the time that people are using that, it quickly starts to make sense.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of cases as well, I think that's a good comment, Alan. I think a lot of cases, a lot of companies that are using these types of technologies probably are also doing something in the AI ML space. So what they could potentially be doing is training people during the day and then training, you know, their workloads overnight. So that is definitely an opportunity out there. The other thing that I wanted to mention, because we started out talking about motion to photon latency, the other thing that is challenging with virtual reality, and John already alluded to it, but with traditional monitors, you know, majority of applications will typically run at 1080p at 30 frames per second. Now, if you look at that combination, it typically ends around being around 60 megapixels per second that's being produced, right? 1080p, there's 9020 times 1080 times 30 frames per second is 60 megapixels per second. If you look at it from a virtual reality perspective, this is kind of different because the Oculus Quest does 72 frames per second. So that's already almost double the amount of frames per second that a normal application does using a regular monitor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
On top of that, we're not talking about a single screen, but these headsets typically have multiple screens. So you have one screen for each of the eyes, which means that now if you combine these numbers, the amount of megapixels per second that it produces, doesn't end up being 60, but it ends up being 325 megapixels per second. So from a throughput perspective, right, it's ridiculous the numbers that a single headset are producing. It's not something that I expected, and it wasn't something that I was aware about either. It's not something that I wasn't even thinking about when we started this project. But it's all the type of stuff that you start to figure out along the way. For me, it took about 2 months before I figured out, you know what, there's a lot of challenges that come into play. It's not just the latency, it's also the throughput. And all of these images, they also need to be rendered in some shape or form. So from a graphics rendering standpoint, that GPU technology, the GPU that's going to be used, it's going to be used in a very intensive way.
And I think the other thing to throw in there as well is the fact that this isn't some 2D image that we're seeing here. These are actually 3D objects, right? I mean, you can create an application, as Duncan mentioned earlier on, these mobile headsets have a small GPU in them. You can create an application that has, you know, between 200,000 and 500,000 polygons in a model, and you could see that absolutely fine on the headset. Once you start to get above 500 polygons, that's when the actual headset's GPU starts to give way and you actually start to get sick inside the headset. So, you know, actually putting this on the server means we can get a lot more polygons within these models and we can push that down to the headsets.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And one of the things that we tested, Alan actually recorded a demo for that. The guys actually created this rocket engine model with 12 million polygons. And what Alan actually did, which I think was a very smart move, was interesting as well. He created it as a native Quest application, and then we created it as a regular VR application that ran on top of Steam VR and rendered it over to the headset. And we compared both of those recordings. So it's very obvious from those recordings, and we'll probably be able to share it at some point in time when NVIDIA Cloud XR is going to be officially GA'd by NVIDIA. And we'll probably be able to share the demo. You will see a very significant difference between the application, which is remote rendered, and the one that is natively running on top of the Quest. I mean, the one that's natively top running on top of the Quest, it's maxing out the Quest in a very obvious way. And I know when Alan did the tests, he definitely got sick. So it's that wasn't a pleasant experience.
I had to take the headset off. Absolutely. There's a point in the video where it just goes black because I take the headset off.
I like it. So yeah, you definitely learned a lot in your 3 months. You obviously learned that, you know, these applications are very resource intensive, and that the architecture is very specific, and there's certainly a lot of points of failure. I know you've been writing about it. I know you've even presented at some VMUGs, some virtual VMUGs, you know, about some of the things that you learned. But what were some of the things that you took away from this project? What did you learn that you didn't expect when you were in this project?
Yeah, that was interesting, to be honest. There were a lot of things that I learned, to be honest, both from a personal perspective, but also from a technology standpoint. I mean, I think first and foremost, if you look at the project as a whole, I think I underestimated the complexity. You know, you think, how difficult can this virtual reality thingy be, right? It's playing Beat Saber all day long. Well, it wasn't actually like that. There were a lot of different things that I need to figure out. Like Alan already mentioned, you need to figure out what the use cases are to understand, you know, in what kind of shape or form people would like to use the technology before you can actually start the project itself. And then when you start looking at all of the different types of technology, you start exploring the different protocols out there, and you figure, you know, this is the protocol that I need to start focusing on. You need to come up with a plan to actually test these different types of technologies. And that was probably, for me at least, the most interesting part. We started having conversations with the VMware performance team. And the one thing that they mentioned is, you know, if you do these tests, first of all, you need to have at least 5 similar runs for every single test that you do. And what we wanted to achieve, or what we wanted to figure out, is how many headsets can we connect to a single physical GPU using vGPU, so virtual GPU technology.
Yeah.
That is what we wanted to figure out. Where does the solution actually max out? Where does the GPU max out? Mm-hmm. Can we max out the GPU, or is it CPU or memory that's going to be the problem? So they said, well, you know what, do these tests 5 times. So you do 5 tests with a single GPU, collect all the metrics. You do 5 tests with 2 vGPUs with 2 headsets. Then you do 3 headsets, you know, so forth, so on. And I started doing these tests. And basically what I was doing is I was holding these headsets in my hand and just basically hovering them around the scene and trying to figure out what it looked like. And I was collecting these metrics. But then I realized, you know what, it's not going to be very consistent. So I needed to figure out a way to actually consistently move at the same speed and with the same pattern through this virtual reality scene. Well, how do you do that? Well, Alan, I think it was Alan or one of the other guys that came up with the idea. They said, well, we may be able to use a turntable. So you place the headset on top of a turntable, you spin it around at a certain speed, and then at least it will always be moving in the same pattern. But the problem is, you know, I was in Palo Alto testing these things. I only had 2 days, and I couldn't find a turntable in the office, of course. So what we ended up doing, or at least what I ended up doing, is I figured we can use our controllers as well to move through the scene. So we ended up using a paperclip, some tape, and a stapler to lock the controller in a certain position so that it would always move at the exact same speed through that virtual reality pattern. Now think about that for a second, right? We're testing the latest and greatest technology. NVIDIA Cloud XR hasn't been announced yet. We're using virtual reality. We're remote rendering this rocket engine, and we're leveraging, you know, tape, a paperclip, and a stapler to stick that controller to a certain, you know, to a certain level, so that always moves through that scene in the exact same pattern. But the funny thing is, it actually ended up working. So I was capable of testing multiple headsets through that fashion, moving through that scene in the exact same pattern. And
this is why I like Duncan working on this 3 month project for us. He doesn't stop not having a turntable.
No.
He comes up with a way to do it with paper clips and plastic.
I just envision him walking around his house. I just envisioned him walking around his house. Who took my stapler?
Exactly. Yeah, it was a funny scene. I'm pretty sure the people that were walking around the office every once in a while, they were looking into the lab where I was sitting, like, what the hell is this guy doing? What on earth? But, you know, anyway, the interesting thing was, I think it was one of the last days, we started looking at these the numbers that I've managed to gather. And just imagine it's not, you know, 2 or 3 metrics, right? We're doing full ESX top dumps, basically to collect every single metric that is out there. On top of that, we're using NVIDIA SMI. So we can collect all of the different NVIDIA metrics as well and start trying to figure out where is the bottleneck. So we're looking at things like physical GPU utilization, GPU memory utilization, frames per second from an encoding perspective, latency from an encoding perspective. But in the majority of cases, at least from a GPU utilization perspective, it all looked okay. Memory utilization also looked okay, but we saw something strange from a frames per second happening. And what was quite obvious at that point in time is when we start ramping up the number of vGPUs, and as such, the number of headsets connected to a single GPU, we would see the frames per second going down and would see the latency from a frames per second standpoint, or the time that it would take to produce one of those frames go up as well. And what we actually managed to figure out is that we weren't capable of maxing out the GPU itself, but we were maxing out the encoder on the GPU card.
Ah.
And that was causing the bottleneck. So that was causing the latency issue. And that was also causing the fact that the frames per second was going down because the encoder simply couldn't keep up. That was also the point in time, by the way, where I realized that we were maxing out the encoder simply because it wasn't a single headset is two or three encoding sessions. It's two encoding sessions because you have two eyes, so you have two screens. Plus, on top of that, you also have a virtual desktop that needs to be encoded in some shape or form. On top of that, when you add an additional headset, it's an additional three encoding sessions. So it actually starts adding up extremely fast. And that's not something that we had realized at the start at all. We figured out that the bottleneck would probably be, the Wi-Fi network.
Yeah,
maybe even the CPU, maybe the memory that is assigned to it, or, the processing perspective from a GPU perspective, but that wasn't the case. It was the encoder on the GPU itself, which was limited. And my guess is that that was primarily happening because these devices, the GPU devices, weren't really intended for these types of workloads. So they weren't intended for graphical workloads.
Wasn't designed for six displays or nine displays it wasn't.
Yeah, well, they may have been designed for nine displays, but not for nine displays with a 72 frames per second expectation, right? Because if you do VDI, with VDI, your expectation is going to be a lot lower. You can easily handle 30 frames per second. Lower than that, you're okay with that. In this particular case, as soon as you start diving towards 30 frames per second, which happened in our case, you will start getting motion sick. So it's that was an interesting find.
Now, one question I had is you mentioned there was an encoder dedicated just to the back-end desktop. Is there a way when the app goes full screen that you can kill that thread or just set the desktop to be a black image and like just a claw one back? Or is the load on that, is it not there's a fixed number of encoders that get locked up or something?
Yeah, and it's something that we did some testing around as well, and we ended up using the Horizon Direct client, so the Direct Agent, so you can directly connect using Horizon.
DCIU or whatever it is, yeah.
Yeah, and that actually has an option to disable GPU encoding, so we ended up doing that, but even with three headsets, the three headsets, because they are doing 72 frames per second, you ended up with like a 92%, 93% encoder utilization. So two headsets was for us the most that we could run against a single physical GPU. But it was interesting because we did find out that you could disable the encoding from a desktop point of view.
Yeah, don't forget, you could get multiple GPUs inside the server, which is essentially what we had. So that he's not talking about the number of users per server here. He's talking about the number of users per GPU.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, exactly. Now I know there's a finite amount of GPUs you can stuff in a server generally because of physics and thermal. But what about if we start attaching GPUs that are outside of a server that we're delivering over an intercept call redirection, over an RDMA fabric, or a PCI Express like Crossbar? At what point do we start disaggregating because the GPU to CPU relationship starts getting out of whack? Makes more sense.
Well, I mean, to be honest, in this the server that we were using in the lab, we had three GPUs sitting in there. So those were three RTX 8000s. But NVIDIA, for instance, also has their own server line. And in their own server line, I think they have solutions where you can actually fit eight GPUs. And I know that Dell EMC has those as well. So, and external rendering. I know some of the guys in Alan's team actually have those remote rendering external rendering boxes where they connect them directly to their laptop. But of course, those could be connected to servers.
It's Thunderbolt,
as well,
so a PCI.
Yeah, exactly.
PCI over cable.
Yeah, I don't think that was part of the work that Duncan needed to go into. He was making sure that this was technically sound and that we could get to a certain point and understand where the restrictions were. Obviously given an unlimited budget, we would be able to push this a lot further. But the end of the day, we need to keep the use cases in mind that our customers are going to be using this for. So the work that Duncan did was absolutely perfect for what we needed to achieve.
No, I'm just thinking more like when we, down the road, I'm sure, as we try to conquer the world, try to take this to utility scale compute models or something. So
yeah, no, I'd love to get that far.
I like it.
Well, one day at a time.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like it was a pretty successful 3 months, Duncan. You, you're able to contribute some of your understanding of vSphere architecture, and you're able to learn a new thing. So all in all, I think this was a pretty positive experience.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was a great experience. I really enjoyed being part of the team. I mean, first of all, the VR team, they're all fantastic guys, right? It's just a great group of people, and I had a lot of fun, and they really took the time to explain to me what the use cases were and how to use the technology. And I could ping them basically any time of the day. It's a bit strange because one of the guys, I know he's based out of Palo Alto, but it didn't matter whether it was 8 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, 10 at night for me, right? So it would be midnight for him. That guy would always respond. And even now, every once in a while, he pings me, and it's just going to be a random, completely random time. So it's just, it was a lot of fun. And I learned a lot, not just about VR, but also about, how to run these types of projects. And I think that for me was definitely one of the reasons I wanted to do this. I just wanted to get outside of my comfort zone, do something different for a change, get to learn new people, but also, learn something about yourself, get uncomfortable and do stuff that they haven't been doing or have never done before.
Good stuff. Well, yeah, we're always excited to hear what's going on in the augmented reality space. Alan, I hope you can come back on and share any new information, as time goes on. And heck, John, maybe you and I need to get some headsets and head over to Alan's group.
Yeah,
I've got a cheese like Windows Media one, but I'm going to need to get some recommendations, Alan, from this, of what hardware I need to upgrade to.
No problems. Anytime. I think, just kind of wrapping up the entire episode and kind of giving you next steps. I think the work that Duncan did was absolutely fantastic. One of the outcomes of what he did during this 3 months is a white paper. So very soon you're going to see a white paper released from VMware that actually tells you how to do this from a vSphere perspective, the kind of considerations that you need to think about, the kind of use cases and how you can push those limits and what those numbers are. And, Duncan did a great job of documenting all that stuff. So that's going to be available soon. The other thing I would say is, if you have this kind of use case, then feel free to reach out to me. My email is renoufa@vmware.com. I'd love to have a chat with you, understand what your use cases are. We've done a bunch of work wrapping up the work that Duncan did around remote rendering. He spoke about it being an application that you have to launch inside the VM. We didn't even talk about how you broker those kind of connections and how we make sure that multiple people can access those applications through a VR client and do the work that they need to do. So, that's the kind of stuff that we're continuing to work on, and I'd love to hear from customers around. The other thing I would say is earlier on this week, a member of our team did a great webinar on augmented reality and showed you how you can create an augmented reality application that takes you through a Lego manual and shows you how to build a Lego object. It was on the 4th of May, so he was showing you how you can build a Star Wars Land Cruiser. it was a great demonstration, a great video, so make sure you go and check that out as well.
Yeah, I'll be sure to put those on the show notes of this podcast. And Duncan, obviously, when the white paper comes out, we'll add that after the fact. Hopefully we can get first hands on that. That'll be good. Sweet. Sounds Alan, good. Duncan, thank you so much for joining this podcast this week. John, anything else before we let him go?
No, that's it. Just after the show, again, we need to talk headsets. So I got a 1080 Ti here. I need some room scale goodness here. So
it's all about mobile headsets now.
You guys have a couple of thousands of listeners every single episode. So it's about time you guys get a sponsor, I guess.
I guess so. We'll have to listen to the after show for the sponsored headset recommendations. All right, well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this in all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to Alan and Duncan for joining us this week. We're back next week, but until then, happy Memorial Day.
Enough of this jibber jabber.